Well, hello everybody, let's get started. My name is Courtney Darrow and I will be your acting facilitator for today's webinar. First, I'd like to thank you all for attending. It's you that makes our work possible. Today's webinar is a great opportunity to share, learn, participate, ask questions, and get involved. We're excited to share the latest information on clean energy policy, technology, and science with you through our monthly webinar series. I want to take a minute and orient you with the control panel located on the right-hand side of your screen. Since the lines will be muted, we ask that you chat in questions, and they will be fielded in the order in which they are received. As I said, this call will be muted and will be recorded. All material from the presentation and audio recording will be available on our website at www.cleanenergy.org in the webinar archive section. Simon Mahan, SACE's Renewable Energy Manager, will help introduce you to this month's webinar on energy transmission. For those of you not familiar with SACE, we're a regional organization with 5 offices across the Southeast. For over 25 years, we've been a leading advocate for clean, responsible energy choices on the federal, state, and local levels. We are a membership organization, and we'd like to acknowledge the members on this call today and encourage those of you who are not members to join us. You can find out more information about membership by visiting our website. Again, thank you for joining us today. I will now turn the presentation over to Simon. Simon? Simon, if you would press *6 to unmute yourself. Hello? Sarah, are you there?
Well, Courtney, this is Jimmy. Why don't we just let him come in and he can say a few words at the end so that we can finish on time here.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay.
So let's start.
Well, thank you all for joining us today. My name is Jimmy Glotfelty, and I'm with Cleanline Energy Partners. And first, I want to thank all of you all for being on the line. We think we have an exciting project here, and we are eager to share it and are glad that you all are interested in listening. I want to thank the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. They've been a great advocate in the South for clean energy for, as you've heard, many, many years. And we appreciate their interest in this. We think they are doing a great job in the South, and we appreciate them putting on this this webinar. I'll tell you a little bit about our company, a lot about our project, some things about the supply chain, a little about the pricing and integration costs of wind and transmission, and then a little bit about the issues that we see are good for us in this day and age for DC transmission lines and some challenges that we still face. Transmission siting is not easy. Always remember that. Courtney, will you change the slide? So first of all, just a little bit about Cleanline. We've been in business for about 2.5 years. We are only interested in building transmission lines and only DC transmission lines, high voltage direct current transmission lines. We are not interested in serving load as a load serving entity, and nor are we interested in being the owner of wind farms. We're solely trying to build the delivery system for wind from windy regions to faraway load centers. We think that this is a big enough challenge in and of itself. It's a pretty simple model for us to follow, but it is a huge project, a huge undertaking to do just the transmission piece. So we feel that's where we need to focus our expertise. And as you all know, there are many others doing the wind side of it. So they can manage that expertise. We'll focus on the DC transmission side. We're very lucky in the fact that 2.5 years ago, our investors are primarily families. They had an interest ensuring that the wind business grew in the United States. And when you get investments by families, they have a longer-term horizon for a return on their money. Unlike a private equity firm that may want to return in 2 or 3 years, a family has quite a bit of flexibility, and we've been very lucky to have the Ziff family from New York as our primary investors. Next slide. So as you can see on this series of slides, the purple wind is clearly the best wind in the country. It is in the center of the country in the Plain States. In the chart on the left-hand side at the bottom, you can see that the high-voltage system is not in the same place as where the wind blows dramatically. This is the vexing problem that we're trying to solve. There is wind, as you all know, in the purple areas of the United States. Most of that is being used to serve local load. We're not trying to serve local load, as I said, but what we're trying to do is ensure that the excess wind in those regions can be exported. The transmission system today is not available to export power to the regions of the southeast and the eastern part of the United States. That is the issue that we're trying to solve. Next page, next slide. So why do we think we can do this? First, I want to say that in 2008, there was a Eastern Interconnection planning effort that began with the Midwest ISO. They were joined by PJM, New York, New England, TVA, Entergy, CERC. I think Western was involved. But what their goal was to see what was necessary to if this country was going to move towards 20% wind, what is the best, most cost-effective, and most efficient way to move that power that's in the center of the country to the east. And they came up with the idea that 7 high-voltage DC transmission lines were a way to ensure that power would move to the farthest reaches of the East Coast and serve the most load with that 20% wind. This is a great validation for us that DC lines not only are valuable, but they are the most cost-effective way to move large amounts of wind long distances. Next slide. Clean Line has 4 projects. They all have different names, as you can see. The Rock Island Clean Line will go from northwest Iowa to just south of Chicago. This project will pick up 3,500 megawatts of wind in Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. The Grain Belt Express will go from Spearville, Kansas to south of St. Louis. Each of these are 500 kV DC lines. The Grain Belt Express will pick up about 3,500 megawatts of wind in and around the Spearville area, move it to the Midwest ISO region south of St. Louis. The Centennial West line is northeastern Oklahoma to a substation in Southern California, which we are still evaluating. We have a handful of them that we've been looking at. As you can imagine, getting into Southern California is the hardest piece of that problem for not just us, but for any transmission company trying to move renewables. And the project that we'll talk mostly about today is the Plains and Eastern Clean Line. This is from Woodward, Oklahoma to Memphis, Tennessee, and it will pick up in 2 phases, but the first phase will be 3,500 megawatts from the southwest Kansas, the panhandle of Oklahoma, and the panhandle of Texas, and move it about 800 miles to Memphis, Tennessee, into the southeastern United States. We'll interconnect with the Shelby substation, which is a 500 kV substation that TVA owns, which gives you access to their west to east, very strong 500 kV system. We are, with these 4 lines, we don't anticipate that we'll have any more projects. 4 projects with a staff of about 45 people is more than enough for us to do. But we feel that the amount of wind that can be created if these lines are successful, somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 or 16,000 megawatts of wind, would be an amazing success story for our country and for our company. Next slide. All of our projects are have a pretty common rationale, and as I said, kind of the thesis of the company is to go get the best wind. The reason why we want the best wind is they are the highest capacity factors, which means the lowest prices. We are using all DC transmission lines. That's because, again, this is a price issue. How can we move the most amount of power the farthest distance and keep the prices down? We believe that, as we get into this tough budget time in Washington, as there's not a federal RPS, that really price is the best indicator of how much wind is going to be purchased going forward. And if we can get the highest capacity factor wind, move it on the most efficient transmission system, then we believe that we'll be at a competitive advantage to ensure that our transmission line is successful and wind is actually developed and sold across our line. The length, as many of y'all know, DC transmission lines, there's kind of a break-even point. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 or 500 miles, by which, if it's any shorter, it doesn't really make sense to use DC. All of our projects are above that length, 550 to about 800 miles. DC technology we've talked about. And then the model that we're using is much like a pipeline model. It's called we call it the merchant model, but in fact, with DC lines with a converter station to put power on and one place to take power off, it's a pretty easy financial model for many of those who want to invest in this line to understand. Many of those same investment banks and infrastructure funds understand the transmission model. They understand the pipeline model, and if we can keep it very similar to that, then we think we'll be successful in attracting their lowest cost of capital. Below is a timeline. These timelines for transmission lines always move, but I think what we're trying to show here is kind of a natural progression of the numbers of years that it takes to build transmission and the types of activities that take during each phase. So January of 2010, we kicked off this project. For 3 years, we'll be in public outreach and regulatory approval and siting approvals. Really, 2013 and 14, we complete land acquisition. We sell. We ensure that capacity can be sold on our line. And then once that's completed, we go through construction of about 2 years. So this is not unusual for transmission lines. Sometimes these get shorter and sometimes they get longer, but I think the point is that transmission takes a long time to develop and a long time to build, and we have the resources to get us through the end of the construction phase. Next slide. Again, we've been pretty specific about why we have chosen DC transmission lines, but I think there are a couple areas that I haven't hit. First of all, we want to be efficient in the movement of electricity, but we also want to be efficient in the types of right-of-ways that we use. And a DC transmission line requires a much smaller footprint than an AC line that would move an equivalent amount of power. As you can see the graphic here, an AC system that would move 3,000 to 4,000 megawatts would be three 500 kV lines, a right-of-way of upwards of 500 feet, 350 to 500 feet. A DC transmission line is one pole that has about 3,500 megawatts can travel down that same right-of-way, and the right-of-way is only about 150 feet wide. So we're trying to be good stewards of the land by using the most efficient technology, the smallest right-of-way. The other thing is by using DC lines, we can move our converter station to ensure that we can attract the most wind in the region. So there are some environmental issues that we have to deal with in the panhandle of Oklahoma and Kansas, primarily the prairie chicken, which is being considered for listing as an endangered species. What we can do is ensure that the converter station is as far west as possible, so that we don't disrupt the prairie chicken habitat, that we can ensure that additional wind in this robust region is not disruptive of that. And we feel that our work with the Nature Conservancy in Arkansas and Oklahoma has given us great insight to ensure that we will have the least disruption on habitats as we go forward. I think I've touched everything else. Simpler commercial structure. I think the technological advances, HVDC technology has been around for decades. The United States is not the primary country in which vendors are looking at. I was with Siemens the last 2 days. They're one of the three major vendors for DC technology. And they say somewhere between 20 and 25 DC transmission lines are being built in China as we speak today. They're trying to solve the same problem, which is rich wind and other resources in the central part of the country moving towards the coast where the load centers are. So, again, another great validation, but we're not a big player in this market as we should be. So, next slide. Our specific project is the Plains and Eastern Clean Line, like I said, from Guymon, Oklahoma to Memphis, Tennessee. It's about a $3.5 billion project. We'd like to think of this, that's for 7,000 megawatts of wind. We like to think of this as really two phases, each of them being 3,500 megawatts. So you can kind of cut these numbers in half, roughly. We'll have, it's about 800 miles. We expect the utilization to be over 50%. The capital cost is $3.5 billion. As you know, in this day and age, jobs are really important. Most of these jobs were calculated using an NREL model, so they're pretty well rounded. But if you think about 5,000 construction jobs and about 500 operational jobs, not only for the transmission line but for the wind facilities as well, it's a huge amount of jobs that the country needs in this time frame. Next slide. Oh, wait, one other thing on this is, if you go back one. So as you can see, the delivery area, we're not just thinking that customers in the Tennessee Valley Authority would be the ones to access this power. The goal of getting onto their 500 kV system is that it's a fairly inexpensive shipping charge to move that power across the TVA system. They have robust interconnections with Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia. It's important to, from our standpoint, to allow as many entities to have access to this power as possible. So getting onto that system, again, provides a great west-to-east highway that will allow lots of different companies to access this wind in the from the Plains states. Now the next slide. Thanks, Courtney. Obviously, transmission lines are hard to build, and I would say that really the hardest part of transmission lines is the regulatory piece of it. How do you site a transmission line? How do you get the authority to site a transmission line? As many of y'all know, in the pipeline world, if you want to build an interstate pipeline, what you do is you go to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, you apply for a permit. They go through all of the need equation. They manage the environmental process. At the end of that, they determine if you've met the criteria, and they issue a construction certificate. And then you have one entity one certificate, and that is all you need to build your transmission line. Unfortunately, the power system grew up very differently than the natural gas system did, and historically, and as is today, transmission siting responsibility resides with the states. This has been because we had vertically integrated utilities. Plants were built close to load centers. As we've moved through the 92 Power Act, where we really try to promote the wholesale market in the United States, we've gotten away from that. So entities purchase power from all over the United States, and we're using our transmission system differently. So It is a challenge to build transmission lines when you're solely serving the wholesale market, because many state laws really have not been changed, and they still focus on those lines that are needed to serve local load. So what have we done in this regard? We committed at the beginning of this company to work through state processes first. In spite of the fact that they may not all work for us, we felt that the jurisdictional argument between the state and the feds required us to try the state process first. So we have filed to become a utility both in Arkansas and Oklahoma. Arkansas came back and they said that within the context of their law, the way they thought it was written, we were unable to serve, we were unable to become a public utility in their state because we did not have local customers. They said that they were very supportive of the project. They thought more transmission was valuable. They thought the movement of renewables was valuable for the country. But within the context of their law, they weren't sure that they could or that we could not become a utility. They did give us a roadmap for a two different ways that we could become a utility, and we will likely file back with the state of Arkansas later this year. We filed in Oklahoma as well to become a public utility. We late last year we went through hearings in Oklahoma. We initially had 12 entities that were intervening. We negotiated a settlement with 11 of those, or actually 10 of those. One of them withdrew, and Oklahoma Gas and Electric stayed an intervening party. These arguments were before the commission as well as an administrative law judge. Recently, the ALJ came back and was supportive of Clean Line's application and recommend that the full commission support us becoming a transmission-only utility in the state of Oklahoma. So that's not across the finish line yet, but we're hoping that soon. On a project that has that goes through three states, we were trying to figure out, is there a federal backstop? And as most people know, the federal backstop authority that was in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 has been pretty well decimated by the courts in different parts of the country. There was another provision in there called, it was in Section 1222 of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and it's called third-party financing. And what it does is it will allow companies like ours to enter into a partnership with the Federal Power Marketing Administrations in the states that they work, and in this case, that's Oklahoma and Arkansas, and partner with them to site these lines. This has been done in the past with the federal government, with the Western Area Power Administration. It has not been done with Southwestern at this point in time, but we have an application pending before them. And that would allow us to do two things. It would allow us to begin the NEPA process now. We feel that if TVA or any other federal entity in the East would buy capacity on our line and wind over our line, they would have to do a environmental impact statement. This is something that we would pay for. Our investors are supportive of that, and we have the resources to do so, and we want to begin that now. But what we need is DOE to finalize this partnership, or Southwestern to finalize this partnership. And I'll get into that a little bit later. Next slide. Again, so why do we think we'll be successful? First of all, it's because, you know, we weren't the first ones to come up with this idea. The JCSP suggested that DC transmission lines were a very viable and cost-effective option to move power from the wind belt or the plain states to the coasts. So from a technological standpoint, from a pricing standpoint of transmission, they were a pretty good roadmap. The other thing is the price of wind. And while we don't have a federal renewable portfolio standard, and while there are not many, in fact, maybe just one RPS in the southeastern United States, the fact of the matter is if entities want to purchase renewables, then wind from the plain states is the most cost-effective answer that they can look towards. So what we've done on this slide is we've put the kind of the average price or ballpark price of all of these different types of power. So if you want to go offshore wind, really there's only one entity that's been approved, Cape Wind. We support Cape Wind. Cape Wind is an example very much like ours, where it's a big project. If we talk about offshore wind, we want to know if we can actually do it or not. And they're kind of blazing the trail in that regard, and they probably have a role in our power supply mix going forward. The challenge is it's very expensive, $230 a megawatt hour. So that's probably the priciest renewable that you're going to find. California, you have their wind prices are about $95 a megawatt hour. These are all just power prices. These aren't even transmission prices. Solar in the Southwest, $150 a megawatt hour. Biomass in the Southeast, about $80 a megawatt hour. And then I think you have the last two, which are wind in the Oklahoma Panhandle, between $30 and $35 a megawatt hour. You know, most PPAs are not made public, but we have relationships with lots of developers that say around the $30 range is really where it is right now. So if you look at the box, $30 wind plus the transmission cost to get us to Memphis is $55 to $60 power in the southeastern United States. I've spent time with I had some discussions with different folks, commissioners as well as staff at the Georgia Public Service Commission. They were surprised that the costs were so low. In fact, they said, "Wow, that's lower than Georgia Power's avoided costs." So, I think the argument that wind is expensive is an old argument. New technology, less supply chain, lots of less pressure on the supply chain, more facilities here in the United States, more efficient processes, and more technology within the turbines, longer blades are allowing for a much less expensive wind price. And this is unlikely to change. This is one that is likely to stay this way, you know, relatively low for quite some time. Next slide. I won't go into this too much. These are just the different components of the cost of wind plus transmission. Again, our modeling shows that $57.17 is a estimated cost delivered to TVA. The levelized cost for a natural gas combined cycle plant, according to EIA, is about $62 a megawatt hour. So you're seeing that even today, that wind prices with transmission, with the capital costs, can be below that of a natural gas combined cycle plant. The one thing I would say is about wind is a great natural hedge against rising or volatile natural gas prices. The fact that when you sign a wind PPA, there's no fuel price or fuel pass-through. So you have one price for the entire life of the purchase power agreement, so 20 years. So in this example, if it's $57.17 for a purchase power agreement, it'll be $57.17 per megawatt hour for the life of that for 20 years with no fuel pass-through. So the point here is clearly wind is least expensive. There have been numerous other studies, some on Wall Street, others by DOE, that show this same pricing issue, that wind today is much less expensive than combined cycle and other forms of generation. Next slide. Again, this is just another slide that deals with pricing, ones that deal with other types of resources. The Southeast, clearly, they have are betting a lot on nuclear. If they can get their licenses, they have good loan guarantees down there. I think reactor designs are being approved. But I think the lesson here is neither nuclear nor combined cycle can satisfy the entire demand of the southeastern United States. You have TVA, you have Southern Company, you have other utilities down there that are facing some big question marks on how they look at their fleet going forward with numerous cost issues and environmental regulations coming down the pipe. And I think that the more they look at wind, as a component of their portfolio, the better off they're going to be. And again, I think folks in the Southeast are opposed to mandates. A federal RPS is a mandate. If we can convince them, if we and others can convince these utilities that buying this in the open market at a fixed price is a good deal for their ratepayers and their shareholders, then I think they'll do that. But it's incumbent upon us to make that case and to help satisfy that those pricing points. So we have our work cut out for us, but all the data that's lined up shows that we actually can do this. Next slide. So wind integration costs, most folks hear that wind integration costs are very high. I'll point to one study that we've done, but there are others. The New England ISO has done one, and so has Black & Veatch, and ours confirms this, that basically about 10% of the wind that's integrated into a system is what's needed as standby backup generation. And what I mean by that is if you look at scenario two here, there's a red circle, 332 megawatts. If we would move 3,500 megawatts delivered to TVA, we would need 332 megawatts of standby generation, ancillary services, to ensure that we can back up that wind. 10% across the board, that is basically what all of these studies have said. This is a number that we've come up with, AWS, True Wind, and Clean. They did the analysis using some real wind data that we have and some real load data that TVA gave to us. So these numbers aren't huge. The natural gas folks said you need, one gas megawatt for every wind megawatt. That's far from the truth. And I think what this shows with lots of natural gas generation being used at 20% of the time in the southeastern United States, that they clearly have the megawatts that are on standby without building another megawatt of natural gas-fired power down there, that they have the ancillary services available to integrate wind into the southeastern United States. Next slide. So what's working in our favor? We, as I've gone through, project economics are clearly working in our favor. Public acceptance at the local level. We've spent, the better part of 2 years meeting with people at the county level, at the, with the landowners, businesses, and they get it. In our area where we're trying to build, they are used to infrastructure. There are pump jacks, all over Oklahoma. They are producing oil and gas. There are pipelines. They are the exporter of energy for the United States. And there is some sort of acceptance, some level of acceptance. That doesn't mean complete acceptance, but some level of acceptance at the local level that is very, very encouraging. There's plenty of money out there. Once we get our regulatory approvals, we don't believe that there'll be any challenge getting project financing for this type of project. HVDC technology, as I've said, is being used globally, and it's a great proven technology that provides not only energy services but reliability services as well. I didn't really say this, but adequate wind resources. SPP has tens of thousands of megawatts in their generation interconnection queue. So 3,500 megawatts for our first phase is a small blip of wind being taken and exported out of that region. I think there are 12,000 megawatts that they can use inside the region, and they're between 35 and 45,000 megawatts in the generation interconnection queue. So they have to find a home. They cannot find a home within SPP, so they're going to have to be exported if they're going to get built. FERC's negotiated rate structure is pretty simple. That's the method by which you negotiate rates with an anchor tenant. They're understood. They've been they're understood by not only investors but regulators as well. So we think that's a pretty good structure. And then you know, we continue to make the argument that as folks in TVA and in the Southeast United States acquire PPAs, TVA has done upwards of 1,300 megawatts in the upper Midwest. Very little of that is actually getting to the region because of curtailments due to congestion on the transmission system. But a DC line allows you to go point to point. There's no congestion cost, and that's a better long-term decision for ratepayers, we believe. Next slide. So issues that are a challenge. It's a antiquated state siting laws. I think I went through some of that a little bit as well. It kind of goes hand in hand with no federal siting laws, but we think that between the state siting laws and the feedback we've been given and the federal process with Southwestern Power Administration, that we will have the authority to build this line very, very soon. We think that goes hand in hand with a lack of federal leadership. The president has spoken dramatically about these issues, but it's very hard to get through this administration to execute anything. So we think that hopefully they will, here in the next few months, finalize our partnership agreement with Southwestern and show leadership, show that they can, in a free market manner that requires no federal funding, supply renewables to the southeastern United States in a competitive manner. HVDC interconnection, I think we're kind of working our way through this, but we have to deal with the Southwest Power Pool, TVA, PJM, MISO, and some other utilities that actually aren't even in RTOs. But there's really no process for interconnecting DC transmission lines. As y'all might know, DC transmission lines kind of look like a generator on the receiving system since there's no congestion on the line. And what that means is unless you have a transmission-to-transmission interconnection process like PJM, very few of them do, then there's really no way to or no specific place where you put this interconnection process. And we've been working through it with MISO and PJM as well as SPP, and we think we can probably take that off, but we'll have to see, when the interconnection studies get completed. I say this, the incumbent sandbox, transmission utilities, vertically integrated utilities, like their space, and they don't like competition within their areas. That's kind of a natural fit for a monopoly. They think kind of in a monopolistic sense. But if they look closer, we're not competing with them for load. We're not competing with them for generation. We're a different type of entity. And we have said over and over as we've met with them that when the timing is right, we would love to partner with them. The reason why we think it's not yet is because they don't have the resources to look outside their service territory. They're regulators. Their investors, Wall Street, they get their high ratings as a result of the fact that they keep their system reliable and they serve power reliably to their customers. They're not paid to look outside their region. So when that time comes, we'd like to partner with them, but we know that it's not right now. I told you a little bit of the numbers on integration. This is a science that has not arrived yet. We've done our studies. We think there's a lot more work that needs to be done on how you integrate renewables. We'll be leading that charge with the load serving entities in our regions, but we definitely believe that that there's a bit of work to do in this area. Lack of motivation by DOE, I think, revolves around the Section 1222. We've had our application pending for about a year there. It is a important partnership, and we think that, again, we will get this partnership very soon and that we will be able to move out. So I think – go to the next slide. Okay, so that's the last slide here. I did want to bring up two other issues that deal with transmission and how it's looked upon in the Southeast. First of all, the construction of transmission lines in and of themselves is a huge supply chain, a huge driver of jobs in the states that we're working in, as well as in the southeastern United States. If you look at the transmission alone, a line such as ours for about 800 miles will use in the neighborhood of 4,000 steel monopole structures. It will use 25 to 26 million feet of conductor. These are things that where we have contracted with entities in the in Oklahoma and Arkansas. They're going to keep jobs in their state, providing us these the supplies that we need to build this this line. These numbers are staggering, but the 164 million pounds of steel, 219,000 cubic yards of concrete. These are things that have to be pretty regionally, or at least the concrete, pretty regionally procured. There are lots of probably more than you think, vendors that are in the southeastern United States that are part of the wind supply chain. They are becoming more and more prevalent. I think we've had a big turbine manufacturer announce a project in North Carolina. I think you're going to see more and more of these folks coming to the forefront, especially as the American Wind Energy Association conference, the AWEA Wind Power 2012, is in Atlanta next year. So there is a huge benefit in our minds for getting wind into the southeastern United States. I can say that all day long. Listening to your local utility is one that might tell the story a little bit better. So I'll end on this note, and that is that Alabama Power, obviously a subsidiary of the Southern Company, one who has steadfastly said that renewables, there are not enough renewables in the southeastern United States to comply with an RPS, and that's probably true. But they have executed a wind purchase power agreement with a company in Oklahoma for 202 megawatts of wind. It's dependent upon getting transmission to actually get it into the Tennessee Valley and into the Southern Territory. But the filing, they have said that it is lower than their avoided cost, and it would put downward pressure on retail prices for the life of the contract. So in Southern's own words, these are good for consumers. Wind power is good for rates, and we think that there is, now is the time to strike in a business sense and make sure that we can get wind power into the southeastern United States. So that's all I have. I would love to answer any questions that you may have. I think we have about 10 or 15 minutes, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you all for taking the time to listen.
Thank you, Jeremy. We can begin question and answer session. I wanted, to draw everyone's attention to the sidebar of the screen where you can chat in questions, and they will be answered in the order in which they were received. So let's begin. The first question is, what are your assumptions for wind generation at the bar bus? Unless they are less than $50 per megawatt hour, they are not competitive with wholesale prices in the East, currently projected at less than $60 per megawatt hour. By the way, this caller calculates transmission costs at between $10 and $15 based on a 3.5 cap cost.
Yeah, so I think the answer is, I'll probably answer it a little bit differently, is I think there are differing opinions of what the avoided costs are in the eastern United States for existing generation. Prices are very low, there's no doubt about it. TVA, it is above $65 a megawatt hour. In Southern Company's own filing, they say the wind plus transmission is below their avoided cost. To me, looking at today's avoided cost is only one piece of the puzzle. As you know, Southern Company and others are facing, and this isn't just a Southern Company issue. This is a utility issue in the Southeast. They're facing issues with environmental retrofits. They're either going to have to retrofit existing facilities, which will add to energy rates, or they're going to have to procure new energy. So when you include those costs, I think you'll continue to see the costs go up. Maybe not dramatically, but I think, again, without any fuel costs, wind will be competitive for many, many years into the future.
Wonderful. Thank you. The next question is, in current cost estimates for nuclear construction, it's $10 billion to build 1,000 megawatts. Your presentation suggests that $3.5 billion will transmit 7 million megawatts of wind. Can you ballpark the wind turbine construction cost for those 7,000 megawatts in order to get us an apples-to-apples comparison for the cost of putting
it costs about $1,400 a kilowatt to build a wind farm in this day and age, $1,400 to $1,600. So prices have come down dramatically. The peak of that was about $2,500. They have come down dramatically. And I think prices are going to stay low. At least the construction companies that we talk with and the supply vendors believe that those prices, again, as we've said, the supply chain has taken costs out as they become more efficient, not only in transportation because some facilities are here in the U.S., but startup costs of many of these supply chain companies. They have their processes down. They are more efficient. They know the types of components that they need to build, and they can build them quickly. So all of those continue to push the cost down to around $1,400 a kW right now.
Wonderful. The next question, how do you hedge against dropping natural gas prices? Most forecasts are for gas to be below $6. Through 2025?
Great question. I think it's hard to hedge against dropping natural gas prices, but I think any portfolio planner in a utility will say that you can hedge against it, against prices rising. Other than a financial hedge against prices going lower. $6 natural gas, I think that's $2 above where it is today. I think $6 natural gas will be almost identical in terms of cost for natural gas, construction cost plus $6 gas as it is for transmission. So, or for wind plus transmission. So they are apples and apples comparisons. If natural gas prices stay low, that definitely is a challenge for some renewables, but I think you find that regulators are pragmatic about this, and regulators don't want to put all of their eggs into a natural gas basket where exports, where world events can have a major impact on prices, and that they want to find ways that they can diversify their resource mix.
Wonderful. The next question is, wind may be competitive on peak, but its off-peak is infra-marginal, note especially Pacific Northwest, where recent off-peak hours were negative.
Yeah, great question. The beauty of the resource area where we're talking about is that the wind blows all the time. It's not just one farm. When you look at other wind farms in the eastern United States with 30 and 35% capacity factors, those are areas where wind blows off-peak and at night during the shoulder months when natural gas is used most of the natural gas-fired facilities are not running, but gas is used as a heating fuel. What you'll find in the wind belt is that it blows at a much greater, more regular time interval. And also, as you hook up 3,500 megawatts of wind to a DC converter station, you're going to have an effect of a dispersed set of wind resources that are connected. So the wind resource area may be 100 miles by 100 miles. So each wind farm is about 50 miles or less to our converter station. A 100-mile by 100-mile region is a huge region in which you can draw resources that the wind will blow, be blowing somewhere most of the time in those regions. There have been studies at Stanford and other places where they show that a diverse set of wind resources can improve capacity factors to that of coal plants in the 85% range. Now, I'm not going to go that high. I think that was an academic exercise, but I think the process is still sound, that as you have the wind from a very large and diverse resource area, that capacity factors will go up. And I think we have data that shows that the wind in this region does not just blow in the wintertime and does not just blow at nighttime. The other thing that I might add is TVA and many other utilities in the Southeast have two peaks. They have a winter peak and a summer peak. So as you've gone to a dual peaking system, there is still need during the winter months.
Okay, the next question. What about interruptions of service due to storm accidents or terrorism?
Storms?
Storms, accidents, or terrorism?
Yeah, another good question. We have we've done studies on the possibilities of storms, tornadoes, other things disrupting the flow of power. You know, across any system, these are issues that utilities have to take into consideration as they operate a reliable system. It would be no different with our line than it is with a 500 kV line operated by any other utility in the southeastern United States today or anywhere in the country. There are backup generators. There are units that are ready to stand by to ensure that any power flowing across our line would be picked up. Now, the beauty of a DC line is if we believe that there are tornadoes in the area, we can turn off the line. We can ensure that ahead of time we can work with the operators of the system to ensure that there is not an immediate problem on the system, turn off the DC line so that no power is flowing on it, and if everything appears to be okay after the storm, then you turn it back on and you ramp up the electricity generation and let it flow again. So we have advantages over the AC system when you're moving power across this long distance.
Thank you. The next question is, can you talk some more about how you could procure ancillary services and how much you expect to need based on the level of wind megawatts?
Yeah, so I guess the way we think about this is, as I said, this is not an exact science yet. You know, we think that the level of ancillary services will be somewhere in the 300 megawatt range. It could be a little more, it could be a little less, and it could be different numbers at different times of the day and different times of the year. We think about that, you know, really from the who in the southeastern United States would want to deliver those services, you know, at a competitive price. It may be the system that we deliver into, which is TVA. It could be Memphis Gas, Light, and Water, which wants to get money for their system, although they procure almost every bit of their energy from TVA. And then there are others that can procure power or that we could buy ancillary service from, whether they be independent power companies or other generators. I think it's as much an economic equation. It's a location equation as well, you know, somewhere in the 10% range, and that's something that still needs to be refined We are going to kick off another phase of a study with the Tennessee Valley Authority here fairly soon to try to refine that even more. But I think that's the number that we feel comfortable with today.
Thank you. The next question is, what is the efficiency of conversion from DC to AC?
Well, let me put it this way. Obviously, in transmission system, whenever you move power, you have losses. The AC systems lose power much quicker, especially over long distances, than AC systems. The conversion process, the losses are about 3% in the conversion process on each end, or that's in total, so 1.5 on each end, and then probably an equal amount in the moving of the power along the line. So if you're looking at our line, you know, you're talking between 4% and 6% losses along our transmission system, where it might be two times that for, you know, an equivalent line on the AC side.
The next, I just want to let everyone know this is going to be our final call for questions. If you have a question that you would like to ask, please submit it using the chat feature on the sidebar of your screen. The next question is there a minimum wind power project size for consideration, 100 megawatts, 200 megawatts?
No, I think that is driven by economics, not only of the wind farm, but of the distance you are from the converter station. But we don't have a set amount of we do not have a minimum size of a wind farm that we're considering. We think that,
sure.
I mean, if you think about the time that it takes to put together a purchase power agreement, the time it takes to construct the farm, you know, we know a lot of the companies that have options on land out in this resource area. They have large swaths of land, so I would expect them not to be small farms. They'd be much bigger farms, but that's not something that we have considered and don't think that we would consider a minimum level.
Perfect. The next question is, an NCF of 45% was noted in the presentation. How representative is this value of wind generation, wind strength over large areas where generation might occur?
Well, I think I alluded to that earlier, and in fact, you know, this is probably a little low in this. You know, the net capacity factors is probably going to be above 50%, but that will go up dramatically as you not dramatically. That will continue to rise as you have a larger resource area with those same capacity factors or higher. Again, the capacity factors are rising for a handful of reasons. Many of them are technological issues associated with the turbine, the length of the blades, you know, how the electronics in the generators work, and that the capacity factors are continuing to go up. I don't know what that top level is, but you know, as you look at as we look at the resource region, you know, we believe that you know, in the mid 50s to high 50s are kind of the top of the capacity factor levels, and then if you look at kind of line utilization, that will stay up because the size of the resource area that we'll be drawing from.
Thank you so much. And we have one final question.
Okay.
Would Georgia have to make agreements with other states to get power to us, let's say Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi?
Now, the only thing that they would have to do is procure transmission service from TVA. So we would deliver to the Tennessee Valley Authority. They already have transmission service agreements with TVA as they have interconnecting facilities, and they procure service from TVA, which is about, I mean, if you think it's, I mean, it's pretty short distance, but it's about a $3 or $4 wheel across the TVA system. So if it's, you know, $55 power, you're talking about $58 to get it to Atlanta. So there's obviously a FERC-approved process for how you procure service with TVA, not approved, but it's filed with FERC. The operators at Southern and TVA and all the other utilities in the Southeast are very comfortable with that process.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jimmy. For everyone on the call, this is Simon Mahan. I'm the Renewable Energy Manager at the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Sorry for the technical difficulties I had earlier. I manage the Southern Appalachian Regional Wind Energy Institute. It's a project supported by the Appalachian Regional Commission. And so the RWEI provides these kind of webinars for stakeholder engagement and increasing all of our collective knowledge on wind energy issues. And so I just wanted to thank Jimmy again for his presentation, and we really look forward to hearing more about the progress of CleanLine.
Great. Thank you all very much for attending, and Simon and Courtney, thank you all for having me on.
Thanks, Jimmy and Simon. This has been a great presentation. We appreciate all of your thoughtful questions and your attendance today. We're very excited about our webinar series, as it's a great way for us to connect with you, our members and supporters, on the critical issues we all care so much about. This has been our August webinar of our monthly webinar series, and we hope to see you on future presentations. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook to stay up to date on clean energy issues, and we thank you for your participation. Have a lovely afternoon.
Thank you.